Majjhima Nikaya 89. And what's interesting about it is it's a unique window into how the Dhamma, how the practice changed a bunch of people. In this case, a group of monastics around the Buddha. It's really interesting. During the Buddha's own lifetime. And we're looking at this through the window, through the eyes of someone else looking at this he's a layperson. He's not even that great a practitioner because he's busy being a king. But he was very devoted to the Buddha. So it's sort of like a little window into our practice and who we can be and where it can take us. I think there's a lot to learn there. And, you know, the Buddha himself, I mean, you know, that's sort of the North Star of our practice to awaken as the Buddha did. But it can seem so vast and inconceivable. It can be like hard to imagine us being like that in any way. But these monastics that we're talking about here, they're just folks like us, you know, who, yeah, they decided to take robes, but they're just people who have been practicing for a bunch of years and had some significant changes, which in a lot of ways I suggest is a lot like changes that have happened among y'all that you can see manifest in this circle. So it's kind of beautiful, but we can learn from it. So the core of it is sort of a commentary by this very powerful lay figure, King Pasenadi of the Kosala kingdom, which was in the area where the Buddha grew up, in the western range of the Buddha's range. And he's one of the two powerful kings that the Buddha most connected with and kind of mentored. And they, in turn, these two kings offered a lot of support in various ways. The other was King Bimbisara of the Magadha kingdom. And what's also kind of funny about this sutta is there's an element of surprise. It's sort of this fresh mind thing. Because for those of you who didn't read, I'll give you the brief synopsis. The core of it is King Pasenadi just went out on a day jaunt. He just wanted to get out of the palace and, you know, go hang out in nature. So he goes to this park. And he's just struck how beautiful and peaceful it is. And it kind of hits a chord in him. And he asks one of the ministers with him, you know, what enlightened beings are around here? Because it resonated with a chord of the awakened mind. And someone said, oh, you know, the Buddha is only 3 leagues away, which turns out is 9 miles. I checked. So he goes there. And he already had a relationship with the Buddha anyway. But this was a complete surprise. He didn't plan to go there. And the Buddha, my understanding of how the Buddha, it's not like he was omniscient, like he saw everything all the time. He could see things if he turned his mind that way. But if he was doing something else, he wasn't seeing, you know, everything functioning all at once. So in this case, it looks like he didn't expect the king to appear. And so it's like a surprise date. And what's interesting is when the king arrived, he was struck by the kind of the tone of the gathering of monastics. They're all sitting under trees practicing. And he was struck by several aspects of them. And ends up having this back and forth with the Buddha about that. And he compares this favorably with his own experience of the royal court. And that's sort of a theme in the Dharma about renunciation, about, you know, the way our world is conditioned that if we have all the good stuff, we'll be happy, and if we don't, then we're desolate or something. But in this case, he was around the most powerful and wealthy people in his kingdom. And it wasn't a lot of fun in that court of his. So he was really impressed by these monastics. So there's this kind of freshness and authenticity to this exchange that I kind of really like. And like I said, those of you who read the suttas can correct me, but there's not too many times where someone articulates their sense of what they're seeing with the Buddha and his followers. Not too many times in the suttas. There's not even too many times when anyone talks about how the Buddha was. In Theragata, there's a few instances of that, the poems of the early Buddhist nuns. But it's pretty unusual. It's pretty unusual. And there's a particularly interesting part of this sutta that I've always loved, in which he describes the monastics, how they are, kind of their characteristics in terms that are pretty unique to the Pali Canon. So I'm going to read it to you, and then go through it kind of line by line with like basically 9 little phrases and see what we come up with. So again, if you want to, you know, because they're all different, so if something hits a chord in any one particular one, let's just stop and explore it. And there's often references to how awesomely quiet a gathering of monastics at the time was. Just nobody was talking, and there was a real presence of just silence, a real deep silence, a silence of contemplation. Ah, yes. And the Buddha, Pasanadi, he makes a couple of references to 2 things before I read the thing. He makes a couple of references to the Buddha, to the verbal chaos in his own court. And he says, he's speaking to the Buddha now, I'm reading from the sutta. He says, "Venerable Sir, being a head-appointed noble king, I am able to have executed those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, to exile those who should be exiled." He's all-powerful. "Yet, when I am sitting in council, they break in and interrupt me. And though I say, 'Gentlemen, do not break in and interrupt me when I'm sitting in council, wait till the end of my speech,' still they break in and interrupt me," even though he could have them executed. "But here I see bhikkhus while the Blessed One is teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and there is not even the sound of a disciple of the Blessed One coughing or clearing his throat." And then he compares the behavior in another way of these wealthy and powerful people in his court. He says, "Venerable Sir, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders. Mother quarrels with child, child with mother. Father with child with father. Brother quarrels with brother, brother with sister, sister with brother, friend with friend. But here I see bhikkhus living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing. I do not see any other assembly elsewhere with such concord." So it's this beautiful broad statement about this difference. But here's the essence that I wanted to read to you, which repeats some of those lines you just read, where he's describing how he sees these monastics. He says, "Here I see monastics living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Here I see monastics smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with mind as aloof as a wild deer's." Isn't that beautiful? So let's try a little line by lining and just see what... I'll share a few things and then if it hits a chord, you know. So he says, "Here I see monastics living in concord with mutual appreciation." And I just love the simplicity and depth of that. You know, just the love and kindness is implied. There's a sense of ease and no one's competing against anyone for possessions or position or anything. And then this mutual appreciation is more than just not strife. It's a sense of recognizing something positive and sacred in each other. There's a real sense of seeing. And it's beyond personality and liking. You know, it's not about who likes who, but it's universal. With this whole group of monastics, they see something, and they have this mutual appreciation. And you can, you know, there's some comparison there, because I think we think of our own lives and our friend lives, you know, and we sort of, I don't know, figure out who's our close friends and not so close friends, and make adjustments to some degree, about, I guess. But in Dharma circles, there's a real sense of just that kind of mutual appreciation. It doesn't matter so much whatever we might on a personal level like or not like about someone, but there's something deeper than that. And then he says, the second one, he says about these monastics, without disputing, blending like milk and water. That's such a beautiful phrase, blending like milk and water. You know, and it shows how the monastics have cut through selfing. They're just willing to kind of let go and hear each other and be with each other and have this harmony. And that sort of, they almost like, you know, their individuality kind of disappears in a way because they're blending together. It doesn't matter so much. You know, in our culture, we're so attached to the vividness of our personalities. And, you know, that's what I guess, I don't know, performing, all that charisma stuff, right? But this is like just blending and being in harmony. And, you know, the kind of maneuvering and stuff. I mean, when you look at the world and, you know, all over the place, sometimes it seems like it's just some little boy stuck in a man who's acting out his maneuvering and happens to have a ton of weapons at hand. So a little more blending like milk and water would be a good thing. And, you know, my own sense of that, just from my, you know, experience with Northwest Dharma News, editing that for this last decade, yikes. And because I come in contact with a lot of Buddhist leaders all over the greater Northwest and Western Canada through that. And, you know, they're amazing. I got to say, I've never been disappointed or had anyone be anything other than just kind of this friendly blending together and kind of looking for harmony. And it's been cool. And also the Sims local Dharma leaders, you know, I work with those folks. And it's just ridiculous, the not conflict we don't have. We just kind of joke about it. It's like it's just been smooth as silk. And same with Clear Mountain Monastery. So there's really something happening here, and it's worth appreciating. You know, I think we can look at what the Buddha taught then and appreciate, you know, how far we've come and how real it is in our circles. And it helps us get a sense of where to go. You know, because a lot of these monastics were probably arhats, and maybe some of y'all are. But nonetheless, it gives us a sense of where to go, which is really cool. And the third one is, it says, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Now, isn't that sweet? I mean, that's like active. That's not just sort of, you know, you vanish with the milk and water thing, but then viewing with kindly eyes, that's really an act of loving kindness, a real reaching out or kind of radiating to each other in this very universal way. Think how amazing that was for the king, because his court, everyone's struggling and power struggling against each other, and God knows what was going on in the court. He obviously didn't have all that much control because he could have executed them, but he didn't seem to, you know. But in this case, they're just viewing each other with kindly eyes. And there's this inner light, and you can kind of see in here the interconnection between the inside aspect and the loving kind or the compassion aspect, you know, those two wings of the Dharma, wisdom and compassion, how they emerge from each other, because there's insight here with these monastics, but it also helps the sense of personal division vanish. So they end up having this sense of kindliness towards each other. It's a way that loving kindness emerges from insight. They kind of emerge from each other. And I think sometimes, you know, part of the practice, I mean, I don't know about you, but for me, I just had a whole bunch of vivid stuff going on in my practice, but I kept kind of watching it go by. It was like this kaleidoscope going on, and it's humbling to realize all the odd things that we seem to be made of. But once you sort of get that, then it's like, okay, fine. We can sort of see that in others. Like this other person who may seem odd to us sometimes, no more odd than we just found out we were. And then, you know, it kind of just, we can let go of there being distinction, and we can view each other with kindly eyes. So I think it's really sweet the way that emerges. And sometimes, you know, just sometimes it's a little odd, like around monastics, because I'm around Cloud Mountain, Clear Mountain, Asabu Biku, a certain amount. And this is funny to say, but there's so much clear energy. Sometimes I feel like, oh, we have this special connection. And then I see him do that clear energy with someone else and say, well, that's just what he does, and don't get stuck there, dude. Because it's this really kindly icing, which is wonderful. It's wonderful. So it's pretty funny. And then he says, okay, number four. He says, here I see monastics smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful. Now that's pretty amazing, because you know what people, I've seen some stuff from the Vatican where they just think that Buddha Dharma is this strange, nihilistic, negativistic thing. And some people think that. But this is how it is. Monastic, smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful. I gotta say, most of the happiest people I've ever met have been monastics or lamas or Dalai Lama, And I like that. I think we can sort of, take that in as something we can appreciate about we already do this in this collective here, but still it's a direction, Smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful. That's kind of where this takes us, and this kind of wonder about this dukkha thing. Dukkha, is a huge, important thing in dukkha, but the Buddha said, I teach only two things, suffering and the end of suffering. So this is the end of suffering. We sort of get stuck on the suffering part, but this is the end of suffering when we're not attached and we're smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful. So that is really wonderful. Just pull back the obscurations and that. This is what emerges. I just have more confidence in that all the time. Dalai Lama, look at him. He's so amazing. He's just obscurations pretty peeled away, maybe totally, who knows, but he has this, he's just cheerful and joyful a lot. And then these monks, think about these monks 2,600 years ago. Their physical circumstance is hard enough for monastics now. But then, they were sleeping, on a mat at best, or maybe just outside if it wasn't monsoon, eating one meal a day or whatever people gave them. You could say, and I mean to say this wrong, sleeping outside and eating whatever people give them, that sounds like a homeless person, the way we think of the description, but totally not. There's something else going on, inwardly that makes that completely okay. So they're the happiest because they're just free of all this maneuvering. And then it says, plainly delighting. And there's another flavor, so I just thought to pull that one out too. Plainly delighting. And renunciation gets a bad rap because people think it's giving up stuff you really want because you're trying to be pure or something. But renunciation is really just letting go of stuff that's in the way. So then you can be plainly delighting because it was a big diversion otherwise. So, how cool is that? Just let go of what's in the way. And it doesn't mean, and I think the plainly delighting part's good too, because it doesn't mean you can't enjoy ice cream. Just don't obsess about ice cream. Someone gives you ice cream, fine. Smile and eat it, if that's what you want to do. Or whatever. Or broccoli. I don't know. Or, patting a dog. Or having a dog lick you. Or whatever. Plenty of delight in all those things, but we just don't get stuck. And that's that freedom. That freedom there. The universe is pretty amazing. So we can delight in all those things. Sometimes I learn a lot from our animals. Wonderful cat, awesome cat Arizelle, and the amazing dog Annie. And sometimes Annie is just lying on her back, wiggling away. She's just delighting to be alive. It's the darndest thing. It's so cool. And it's a real privilege to be educated about the simplicity of plainly delighting. And I've seen that around monastics too. It's just like kind of so with Ajahn Riti and other monastics. There's no particular reason why they should be so happy and plainly delighting right then, but they just are because of what's coming from the inside. And then it says number six is their faculties fresh. I'm not quite sure what the word faculties is in Pali, but that's a translation. But maybe it means kind of like your physical presentation, it sounds like, in some way. I don't know what exactly, but you know, it's funny how here in the 21st century, people put so much into cultivating their outer appearance and all that, the presentation, the surgeries, the clothes, the creams, it goes on and on. And then people, they don't seem like there's energy there. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with, you know, we're conditioned to think it has to do with youthfulness, but it's from the inside out. I met Bontaji, some of you may know who he is, famous Sri Lankan monk. He came to Atama one time, a few years ago, Atama Monastery in Woodinville. I mean, he's still alive. He's in his mid-90s now. But when he was there, he was in his, you know, late 80s or something. And he was weathered, you know? But he was just vibrant. He was so cute. He was just mischievous and had this light flowing at him, and you know, there was his faculties were fresh. It was apart from his agedness. It was really wonderful. So Dalai Lama's like that too. You know, he's what is he now? 80 something, right? But that fresh comes from the inside. Yeah, thanks for chiming in, folks, because I think these are so different that it's hard to kind of at the end remember them all. Then number 7 is living at ease, unruffled. Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, you know, it's funny, you know, here where we live in this ridiculously wealthy area. I saw an Aston Martin SUV the other day. I saw a Lamborghini SUV. I can't even believe that exists. And yeah, there is, they exist, they do. But how many people are living at ease, unruffled? You know? I mean, that's something else. That's like a whole other world than what this whole scene's about. And people, you know, here we can be seduced into thinking that creating the best possible circumstance, nice car, nice boat, whatever that is, that's going to bring happiness or peace, but it comes from the inside. And these monks, they were just living at ease, unruffled. Kind of like Ajahn Riti. Because he just rolls with it. And you know, all the high-flying people that we pay attention to, and celebrities and all those kind of folks, wealth techies, media techies, whatever, media celebrities, man, they're farthest thing from unruffled, most of them. It just seems like a can of worms. I don't want to be them. And then number 8, subsisting on what others give. And of course, this is, in a sense, unique to the monastic condition, that the king would have noticed that. But it is, there is something to learn there. You know, I go to offer alms to the Sabu Bhikkhu sometimes, if any of you ever inspired to do that, it's a totally fun way to spend 7 a.m. in Seattle. You sign up on this schedule in the Clear Mountain calendar, and you can go down there and offer alms. It's really fun. But it's just, I'm just so struck how he's completely happy with whatever people offer. It's just like, whatever. That's his food. It all goes dumped in the bowl and, you know, just eats out of the bowl pretty much. I asked him the other day what he does when he's traveling, because he's visiting some other monasteries. And he said, well, you know, because he can't meet afternoon, and if he's in a flight, you know, like a international flight, and the food cart comes by at 12:30, he said, well, I just don't eat that day. But he just said it in this light kind of way, like, no problem, you know, no problem. And there is a lot to learn there, because we spend a lot of energy. I mean, not you all here, I don't know, but we as a culture, we as a whatever we are here, spend a lot of energy pursuing the perfect food moment. I'm always puzzled. We get the Sunday paper, so I read Pacific Magazine a little bit, and it's kind of this food paroxysm, a lot of it. Or sort of like the really nice house paroxysm and the food paroxysm seem to be what it is, mostly. But there was something about some incredible sushi place. I'm sure it's incredible. For $150, he got some multi-course thing, but there was all people like gasping and groaning about how good it was. And it was really interesting.